Hey, everybody, it's Jay Schellen here, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
It's fantastic to have Jay Schellen with us today. He has links with some amazing musicians, musicians we all know and love. Peter Banks, R.I.P., Tony Kaye, Billy Sherwood, Chris Squire, R.I.P., Alan White, Jeff Downes, and so many more that we know. So fantastic to welcome Jay. Hello, Jay.
Hello. How you doing, Kevin? Mark?
Hey, TJ, how you doing?
All right. So we'll come back to all those connections as we go, Jay. But I was fascinated to see that you studied classical piano when you were young and also theory of music. How do you think that background affects how you approach playing in a band?
It affects everything, I think, you know. Mm. Influences are certainly important, but the foundation in the beginning, my father was a ragtime pianist and then also a classical guitarist. He was a scientist. You know, he did a lot of things. And so we had mandatory piano lessons when we were young, and I stuck with it. And so that was my first instrument. But to get to my piano instructor's area, I had to walk through a drum store, Lucchetti Drum and Guitar.
Yeah.
So during those times, I'd walk through and I would just say, you know, there is something so attractive here. I was becoming late for my lessons. And eventually, Nick, I have to credit him with getting the ball rolling, because he stopped my mother picking me up one day and said, you know, Jay's spending more time and more time in this drum shop and he can play. Yeah. You may consider, you know, so that's how that began. But the piano is a percussive instrument, but yet then again, it is melodic, and you learn music theory, of course, to be able to play it. And it was funny, I was talking to some other drummers a while ago, and the subject of toms came up. Why do some drummers prefer very few toms and other drummers prefer a lot of toms? And to me, it comes down to melody and using the toms to create those melodies of a phrase and things like that. So I think that's where piano and scales and knowing your note values, et cetera, all kind of come together and rounds out the whole picture.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of the stereotype, isn't it, that, that the drummer is the guy who hangs out with musicians. But clearly, you know, you will have never had that kind of a problem when the rest of the guys in the band are discussing the chords and the way the thing is all structured. So you can join in with those conversations, clearly.
I can, but you know what? I mean, certainly in present company, I mean, these folks, you know, my bandmates are exemplary, you know, musicians and such. So I can follow along and understand where they're going. You know, it's the language. So that's great. It's rare that I interject, because they're so well versed, but I can provide compositions towards new music and such and that kind of thing, and then leave them to interpret and kind of, you know, take it further.
So with that theory, then Terry Bozzio must be really into melody with all those drums that he has in his head.
Exactly. You know what? You're exactly right. That proves it right there, because he's got every tonality that you could think of an orchestra there, right?
Exactly.
I mean, really. Yeah. And being able to play an individual melody with one limb, including feet, is it's incredible. The ostinato independence of Terry's is just insane. And Alan also was a pianist as well.
Yes.
So we had that in common. We could kind of speak to that kind of influence.
Yeah.
So it's amazing to think that your first experiences of playing with Yes musicians actually involved Peter Banks and Tony Kaye. How did those opportunities come about?
Well, I was 19 and touring on a circuit that would cover the Midwest all the way up to Arizona or so. And I had some very good buddies there that we'd run into in different bands and such and that. A guitarist named Glenn Sherba was in a group called The Offenders. And I had my group out touring too. He saw me and he said, man, if you ever want to come to California, I've got a gig for you. He said, you know, so something to think about. And sure enough, I ended up taking him up on that. And when I got to California, 3 hours later, after arriving, I was down at Sound City and working on a record for an artist named Jeff Scott that was produced by Tony Kaye. And me being the diehard Yes fan, big time, I had Badger, I had everything, I had all the solo stuff and the whole thing. So that was amazing. One of the California dreaming pinch myself moments. But what followed was even more amazing. We had our rehearsals and we discovered Tony and I had a passion for tennis.
Oh, yes, yes.
So literally before I had my first legal drink, we were hitting the tennis courts together and then popping over to the King's Head where I would sneak in a pint or two.
Nice.
And then we were playing at the Central. It was a club, which is now the Viper Room. And Badfinger, that's the next part of the story. After this record, Tony brought Tommy Evans and Joey Molland over, and they asked me to join them in Badfinger. And so we started a new record and started recording and doing some things like that. So we performed to open a new club called The Central, and it was run by English roadies, and it was a place for the touring musicians coming through to the Roxy or to the Hollywood Bowl or whatever, to come over and just kind of have a pub atmosphere. But yet it had a stage and it was a lot of fun to perform. So I became the house drummer there.
Nice.
And Peter Banks then asked me to join him in his group, which by that time, I think it was, we were kind of loosely calling it either the Peter Banks Band or Empire 3.
Right. Yes. Yes.
And so we played once a week, and then I was a house drummer for Bob and Keith's jam night. So the characters that would come through there was, oh man, that's a pinch yourself moment. John Mayall, Robin Ford, Dee Johnson, you know, from Elton's band. Dudley Moore was there all the time. It was just, so the Yes guys, when they were in town recording, and we would leave the Rainbow. The Rainbow Room was a favorite, of course. And we just walk across the street to the Central to finish off our nightcaps. And that involved Chris Allen, Bill Bruford when he was in town with King Crimson.
Yes.
And so it was this very, very English kind of hang. And that's how that all kind of started, really.
That was wonderful. Well, tell us a bit about Peter Banks and Tony Gay. What was it like to play with them, to work with them?
Tony, first getting to know him as a producer and then a tough tennis player. He knew exactly what to do. He'd say, okay, Jay's fast, so I'm going to run him and just run him to death, right? So I got to know Tony in that regard, and you know, his family and such, and then meeting other Yes members, and then playing in Badfinger with Tony. It was how do you say, when you hear in your monitor Tony Kaye on a Hammond organ?
Yes.
there's nothing else like it. And it's surreal.
Yes.
But also such, you know, I went through, we're very, very good friends. He is my longtime friend, mentor. He taught me a lot. And in the later years of 90125, we were still playing tennis and going and playing tournaments and such. And he was rehearsing at SIR.
Nice.
And to hear him branch out and start using synthesizers and electronic keyboards and stuff, it was amazing. The soundscapes that he would create and this and that, it was just great. So that musically was always inspiring, but then yet as a very good friend and mentor, his guidance and his friendship, you know, is treasured. Now, Peter was wonderful to work with because he was very spontaneous and frenetic. So one night we'd be just doing Miles Davis tracks.
Yes.
And then other nights we would do kind of just more atmospheric, kind of Jan Hammer kind of inspired, Jean-Luc Ponty kind of inspired soundscaping. We always opened with Peter Gunn.
Wow, yeah, excellent.
That was our thing. And I really got to know him. We hung out a lot because his apartment was real close by too, to the Central.
Yes.
And he was a wonderful, sweet guy. Super sweet guy. So talented. His sounds were really, really unique. He had a voice of his own, no doubt. And it's, you know, a great loss, you know, for all of us. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So I'm going to preface this question by saying I'm a big vinyl collector. And one of my most treasured album that I got was a gold stamp promo copy of World Trade, the first album that you and Billy Sherwood did together. I love that album. I hunted out a promo copy, gold stamp promo of it, and it's one of my most favorite records to listen to that I have in my collection. So the question is, way back in 1995, you started working with Billy Sherwood in World Trade. Clearly, you know him as a musician really well. What's it like playing with Billy in all the different situations you have done with him?
Well, we were introduced by Bruce Gowdy. I was working with Bruce in a band called Stone Fury. And he said, you got to get together with this, my friend, Billy Sherwood, you know. And once again, tennis was involved, okay?
Wow.
But as soon as we got together at his studio, he had some material for World Trade. And since the group was a bit fragmented at the time, he said, you know, let's you feel like carving something? And I said, yeah, let's do it. And this track was called In Your Mind. And we just laid this thing out and just kind of looked at each other and just said, okay, this is something good. You know, this is something so good. So working with him is extremely inspiring, and it moves at a fast pace. So unlike Badfinger, which we would do pub breaks quite often, you know, we'd enjoy ourselves, you know what I mean? Billy works very quick. Inspiration hits. We do things. I mean, we were doing things that we just were rolling with it and going for it. There was one record we did together called, it was a solo record of his called The Big Piece.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he took something I said almost daily and turned it into the album title and a track title. As I would just walk in and say, so do you feel like working on The Big Piece today? Right?
Yes.
Because we put up a roll of blank tape and we just said, let's fill this up and see what happens. And so that's how that came about. And we just worked spontaneously and in the moment every day. And the creativity that Billy has is limitless. And the energy to do that, create it, produce it, perform it, is endless. And I don't think there's a finer bass player out there. I mean, it fits so well with my idea of rhythm in that he's aggressive. He's very syncopated, but very intellectual as well, mathematically. So it lifts, it really does lift your own style, your own kind of conceptual, you know, performance, because you can go anywhere. And then it definitely sharpens your edge, because to keep up and handle the math, it's a masterclass, put it that way.
So, before we get to you within Yes, there's one more question I want to ask, and that is, you also know Jeff Downes via Asia. So that was, again, a different type of playing situation for you, wasn't it?
Yes. Yep. But I have to say, it's very similar in that they were in town in Los Angeles, and Jeff sent me a message and just said, Billy and I, as Billy's drummer for the writing sessions for Silent Nation. So Billy was writing with John and with Jeff.
Yes.
And so I was playing on those tracks. And Jeff invited me to, he said, you want to have a bash? And I said, you bet I do. You know, so I went over to Mates and we played. And then we went out for some pints. And they asked me to join the band. But speaking to my impression of Jeff, in those jams at Mates, again, I was floored. And I'm attracted to the rhythmic of keyboards.
Yes.
Playing drums to keyboards is one of the easiest things I do.
Yeah.
And listening, we were just jamming. Yeah. And listening to Jeff was incredible. Mm-hmm. Incredible. It's like the Allman Brothers when they're jamming, right?
Yeah.
It sounds spontaneous, but yet so cohesive. So we're playing things for the first time in a room together, number one, but number two, the stuff that we're playing is completely off the top of our heads. Mm-hmm. With Jeff, the mood changes, the soundscapes, the rhythms just spoke and would guide you directly into the support path, you know?
It was
incredible. He just same thing. The creativity is just limitless.
Well, that's great to hear. We are supporters of Jeff as well, of course. But you're now a permanent member of Yes, clearly. But obviously, you were sharing drum duties with the great Alan White for a long time, and I've seen you several times on stage with Alan. And I noticed, though, on your website and elsewhere, you've mentioned Close to the Edge and Tales from Topographic Oceans are some of your biggest influences. So I'm assuming that Alan, as well as Bill Bruford, they're your big drum heroes. Is that right?
Yeah, very true. When I was introduced to Yes, it was Bill's era.
Mm.
And it's extremely captivating. Okay, so I'm a definite Bill Bruford fan, and I love Yes.
Mm.
When I was very young, I heard Instant Karma.
Okay. Yeah.
And that changed my life. It's probably the first time my mom looked at me and said, "What happened to you? What is wrong?" Because I was extremely captivated by what happens drum-wise in that song. I didn't understand it. I didn't know.
Right.
But it grabbed me so hard. So pursuing drums from piano, that was part of the rocket fuel to get that done. That song, right? So later on, I'm a Yes fan, all that. Oh my God. Okay. So Yes Songs comes out and I'm looking forward to it and I get it. And I see Bill on a couple tracks and then Alan White, right?
Yeah.
That blew my mind. I said, something is going on here because Instant Karma, Alan White, Yes.
Yeah.
You know, this is incredible. And so, from that point on, the connections, the way that Alan played was leaning into, because my influences go to a lot of prog rockers, you know, Phil Collins, Tony Williams in the jazz fusion, and Jack DeJohnette, Billy Cobham, on and on, that kind of a thing. But also on the other flip side of things, you know, I was really into John Bonham. You know, and Cozy Powell, and many, many others, right? So in steps Alan, and he is just brutalizing these odd signatures, right?
And
that's a compliment. I don't mean brutalizing, but he was playing them with such feel and just directness and power, right? So from that point on, there's my North Star, right? So that became my thing. And of course, musically, I love to play all styles and all that I'm capable of, and I can hear and perform. And and so I've gone in a lot of directions at times, but always my North Star. So of course, later him, and we've known each other too, because of just the association with all the Yes folks, you know, I kind of was known as Young Squire. I was... the kid that would, they would kind of show up, you know, on tour and stuff because Tony and I wanted to play tennis.
It's good.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And so when Alan asked me to sit in for him on the 2016, of course, I was extremely honored.
Yeah.
But the fact that it involved topographic oceans.
Yes.
And also drama. But topographic oceans is like, that's the one that is so near and dear to my heart.
Yeah. So I gotta ask, because I think this is a pretty important question. And I think for drummers out there who are listening will probably be interested in this as well, is what is the best bit of drumming advice Alan ever gave you?
Oh, you're right. You're right. I think what that would be, I have to kind of comb through a few things. Number one, with Yes Music, there's a lot of keys that unlock what's going on, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And to make assumptions of what you think you hear is not productive. So, well, that's too strong. It doesn't get down to the layer you need to get down to, because I kind of look at it as about 10 layers deep, Yes Music. You can conceive it and think that you have it, layers 1 through 4, right?
Yeah.
But you're not quite close. Then you study a little more, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh, wait a second, hang on a minute, right?
Yeah.
So then in steps Alan, and this was happening all on that 2016 tour, because I would be 5 levels deep.
Yeah.
And I call up Alan and say, Alan, This bit here. And he goes, I knew you'd be calling. And he would give me the way that he counts it in his head.
Yeah.
And the subdivision of the odd phrase.
Right.
Or counting the rests.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So once he gave me his maps, then all of a sudden I got to level 8.
Right. Yes.
And then that was pretty darn good. But then in 2017, we started performing together. And that's when I started getting into those 9th and 10th levels.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Because he'd sit behind me while I'd be playing. And we had so much fun with that. I mean, I love him and I miss him so much. The beauty of the group is that there is spontaneity. It's really complex, and it has to be what it's supposed to be for the band and for the fans and for the music.
Yes.
But there is moments of spontaneity, and sometimes I would just be in the moment and going for it.
Yeah.
And I'd look back, and Alan would give me a tip of his hat and just give me the old attaboy, right? And then sometimes I'd go for it, and I'd look back, and he'd kind of pull his hat down. I'm like, okay, I think you've jumped the shark on that one, right? But in a lot of ways, he trusted the fact that I was so much committed and held him in such respect and such regard and such respect for his compositions.
Yes.
That he knew that I knew them. And when I asked questions to go further, he knew that I really wanted to know them. And at that point, he just said, oh, Jay, you've got this. You sound like me. Right? Now, one thing that I could say for drummers and technique-wise that took me a little while to figure out is Alan does a lot of single strokes.
Right.
Yeah.
Those fast things in Sound Chaser, a lot of those fast fills in Topographic, all that stuff. There's single strokes. There's no paradiddles, and there's not very little double strokes. So over the years, I've done that, playing the music and things. And one day, he was just going, lead with your left. He said, you don't have to hear it, but just lead with your left.
Right? Yeah.
And I said, oh, wow, okay. Let's see, because I knew that was a Billy Cobham thing too, for those really fast blast rolls, right?
Right, yeah.
And I went, okay. So I started leading with my left, but only as a ghost stroke, right? So my right was still felt dominant, but I was leading with the left.
Right.
And that created the back and forth motion that you can go down your toms and you can come back up them.
Yeah.
And it puts your hands in the right place when you're playing very, very fast to hit your downbeats, upbeats, accents.
Mm.
So that as just a particular technique thing that it seems really specific and important for Alan's kind of style, was something that was a bit of a keystroke.
Brilliant.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, we just need to finish off by asking you a bit about the coming tour, and I'll be seeing you on the coming tour. I'm trying to get to your I don't know what you call it, the warm-up gig, which you do down in Devon. But you're playing a medley of tales on this tour, and you did in the US. And as you've just been saying, you learned so much from Alan. But what was it like to arrange that number for the tour? Were you involved in the way that it fits together, or was it more of Steve Howe's vision for that?
This has been, I think, on Steve's mind for many, many years, this kind of undertaking to do all four sides in a medley. So it was 100% Steve's baby.
Right.
And when we got the edits for it, it was incredible. I just kept saying, oh man, he got that one. Oh good. I'm glad oh, that's there. Oh man. Oh, that's there. Oh, perfect. This is great. So all what we had to do together was just smooth some of the edit corners and figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
But as an arrangement, it was Steve's brainchild. And I got to say, it is a challenging, but thoroughly engaging and satisfying piece of music. 20 minutes more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so much fun to play live. And I think it really, really translates. And the fans love it. It takes a minute, because we all know the music so well.
Yeah.
So when the edit happens, of course, it takes a minute.
Yeah.
to go, whoa. but it's so expertly done that that you immediately just jump into the next scene. And it's really beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing it again. I've heard it on YouTube videos or whatever, but first time to hear it actually live.
Yeah. I think that's the key word, boy. It's the band in the room live it's funny, you know, I look forward to seeing, you know, the captures of the shows and everything, but it is just not represented as it really is live
you
know.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So we're going to close off with one last question, and I think this is an interesting question for you. I've heard Cut from the Stars and All Connected probably once live in a live environment when you guys have played it from the new album Mirror to the Sky there. Is it different playing music live that you've recorded yourself?
No, it's all the same because I kind of live in the moment when I'm playing. I mean, I kind of do deep dives. I've described playing Yes music as kind of sometimes diving into a Salvador Dali painting. So that same kind of energy just goes with all of it, actually. I think if you've recorded it, though, you have a tendency to maybe want to embellish a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have laid that down, so it's your composition.
Yes.
So you may think, yeah, I'll just, you know, mess around a little bit here or do this or that. And, you know, you have to resist a little bit because there is room for spontaneity, but you have to keep the composition in order, so to speak. And then when you're playing compositions of Alan and others, so to speak, you know, there's a respect, I think, that I find compelling. You know, to honor the composition of their work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got to ask this, otherwise I feel that I missed an opportunity to ask this. So if you were playing, let's say, Cut from the Stars, and you threw in an odd drum fill that wasn't on the record, would Steve shoot you a look?
Yeah. And Billy would probably look at me too and just kind of go, interesting. Very interesting. But at the same time, I got to say, Steve is very spontaneous too at stuff. And sometimes those looks are very, you know, positive. You know, you throw in a little something and then there's give and take that goes back, because he'll give a look like, you know, he'll point.
Yeah.
And he recognizes it's spontaneous. Fills change. There's certain areas where the fills will change. And then he will reciprocate by a different slide kind of thing that he would do in another, you know, area of the song or something. And he'd look over and I'd look at him, you know, so that it's a lot of fun. And I think that's why fans still and always will love to come and visit us live and see the shows, because it's a one of a kind performance. We do not use click tracks. We do not use sequencing. We don't do any augmentations.
Yeah.
So it literally is a one of a kind performance. Yeah. It happens only that night.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, as I say, I am very much looking forward to coming and seeing you at least once, if not hoping to get to at least two, actually, of your concerts, which will be absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But thank you so much for speaking to us. It's been fascinating to hear all about your background and about the great Alan White.
Thank you, guys. And be sure to try and find me at the show. Let's get together. We'll hang out.
Definitely. Okay. Brilliant. Thank you, Jay, so much.
Fantastic. Thank you, guys. Looking forward to it.
Take care.